Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tour.com podcast. I am Justin Landon, and I am your host. I'm joined tonight by Max Gladstone and Tabitha Jensen. Max is the author of three books, including his most recent release, Full Fathom 5. He's been twice nominated for the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer, and he speaks Chinese. Tabitha blogs at Not Yet Read, her whimsically designed site. She's been blogging for 3 years and is one of my favorite people in the community. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Before we started the show, we spent at least 10 minutes talking about online gaming. Tabitha's a former WoW junkie, I'm a former WoW junkie, and we learned, rather surprisingly, that Max Gladstone had an epic career in the world of text-based MUDs.
I'm not sure I'd go so far as to call them epic, but I lost a really insane amount of time in my basically middle school through about three quarters of the way through high school to a number of different MUDs. I think Carrion Fields was the one I started off on, and then I ran around a whole bunch of different circle MUDs and ended up on a Wheel of Time MUD called Dragon's Fang, or the Dragon's Fang, for a long while. That one was really cool. They had a magic system that they'd hacked to make work actually the way that the power works in the Wheel of Time games. So you could develop your skills in earth and fire and air and spirit and all of those. And like your respective levels would let you do different weaves. It was so much fun.
Yeah, those games were intense. It's kind of where I cut my writing teeth to some degree. Not that I'm necessarily a writer, but I remember building areas and, you know, doing the descriptive text for all of all the rooms that you would go into. And God, I wasted a lot of time.
It was a great way to learn at the very least speed typing skills, because either you had all of your macros set up or you learn how to type like, you know, con thing, kill thing, and then all of your various spells and abilities super fast. Online gaming was actually one of the gateways for me into thinking that like novel writing was something that I could do in a really serious way. I'd always been writing stories, but after I stopped playing MUDs regularly, I started playing a online kind of forum-based role-playing game. If you guys remember the Comic Book Universe Battles site at all, it was the sort of, you know, like the Death Star versus the Starship Enterprise, and then they fight, and then there's sort of descriptions of both of them, and then people vote who would win, and then there's a description of what happens afterward. So there was a sub-portion of this site where people could create their own characters, organizations, situations, and then people who would go to the site would kind of vote on which one would win. So it started off having some sort of rudimentary game mechanic associated with it. You had a certain number of points, and then you had to use those points as efficiently as you possibly could. But there wasn't too much flexibility to the game mechanic, which meant that the real way to win at this game was to write something that was really cool. So whenever anybody read it, they would immediately vote for your guy over the other one. So it was this amazing combative character generation, like comic book over the top Phantasmorgia deathmatch system. And I started writing characters for that and then got involved in writing. It was basically fan fiction. It was sort of stories about all of the characters that my friends and I on the game would make. And I wrote this one that was like 250,000 words long. It's insane. It's still out there in the back channels of the internet somewhere, and realized at the end of this, wow, that was a lot of fun. I want to do that again. I'll see if I can get paid for doing that.
So you're telling me there's a wacky 250,000 word trunked novel floating around on the internet somewhere of Max Gladstone's?
Yes. It is relatively easy to find if you hunt in the right places. Yeah, it's out there. It's in PDF.
Max won't tell us where those places are, but they're out there, so
it could be really scary. It could be really, really scary.
Honestly, like I might put it on my on my blog later as I'm thinking about this. I mean, it's very much the book that you write when you're 16 or 17. It was this enormous apocalypse pastiche with angels and demons fighting each other and like all sorts of different superhero type folks running around and doing things. It was a ton of fun. I haven't gone back and reread it since. You know, in the archives of Juvenalia, like, if you want to, the portrait of stuff the writer thought he was cool when he was 17 and still sort of guiltily thinks is cool, but would never confess that into a room full of people. And so is only confessing that to the entire internet at once. Yay.
Yeah, because the entire internet listens to Rocket Talk. Are you familiar with the fact that, you know, like the Brandon Sanderson manuscript that's like stored away at BYU and there's only one copy of it and it's like on back order for years and years?
Oh, wow. No, I'm not familiar with that. That's really cool.
Have you heard this, Tabitha?
No, I haven't.
So when Brandon Sanderson was at BYU, his
thesis project was to write a novel, and he wrote this novel. I think it's called Dragonsteel, I believe. And it was his thesis, and he submitted it to the school, and it's in their library, and it's a novel, and there's only basically one copy of it, and it sits in the BYU library, and all the students just they check it out, and it's got like a year waiting list to to read it. So it's kind of a cool story. It's similar. So Max, you just need to wait until you're as big as Brandon, and then people will be climbing over themselves for your PDF on the internet.
From your lips, Justin.
Yeah.
Well, I would read it, Max. I don't care if you were 16. I would read it.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I'd probably cringe and go, oh, but I would read it.
Mostly I would cringe because it was in PDF, man. Come on.
Yes. Oh, my God. Don't even get me started about PDFs. I can't stand them.
Yeah, as bloggers.
I wrote most of it. I have somewhere all of it was originally in, bad PHB forum markup. So it could be worse, trust me.
Wow. No, it's funny. I really cut my teeth, not just on MUDs, but also on after the MUDs, I got involved in an AOL Wheel of Time forum community. And
cool.
It was sort of like a role play, active role play on a daily basis. Like everybody in the forums role played. And it extended outside of the forums as well, into email chains and into instant message chats. Like in hindsight, it was a little LARPy and a little outside what I would consider my comfort zone today. But at the time, I mean, it was the best for a 15 or 16 year old geeking out on the Wheel of Time. Other than WoW, Tabitha, do you have any online gaming role playing weirdness from your younger days?
Oh, you know what? I used to play. Well, pretty much, I was a huge Blizzard fan. All those Blizzard games, Diablo and StarCraft and so we used to have telnet, our LAN parties at my friends' houses. We'd all bring our computers over there and it would just be insane. So I had one of the coolest dads that he would let everybody stay the night. He didn't care if they were boys or girls, and everybody would just come over, bring their computers, and we would party it up. It was pretty nice. So other than that, I'm mostly stuck to Blizzard. Because I liked that style and the graphics.
Yeah, I don't think Dad had too much to worry about.
The cartoony look. So that's pretty much it.
I don't think Dad had too much to worry about the StarCraft party.
No.
The StarCraft parties, they can get crazy.
They usually stay.
I know.
It's the Soul Calibur parties that you really need to watch out for.
Yeah. Now that's funny. So we did not come on here to talk about awkward online gaming stories from our younger days. We came on here to talk about other stuff. But before we get too much into this, Max, congratulations on your nomination again for the John W. Campbell Award. This is your last chance, right?
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's the last chance, my last at bat. Very exciting.
Of course, you only get two chances, so it's not like it's been this huge. It's my last chance. I only get two.
Yeah. I picked a hell of a day to retire, or a hell of a day to quit sniffing glue, I guess is the more apposite one. No, I had a great time as a Campbell nominee last year. The class was really cool. Just all of the people who were nominated turned out to be totally excellent and good writers at a huge range of different disciplines. And that seems to be the case this year again. It's such a neat award from my perspective because it brings a lot of folks who are very early in their career and are not all doing the same thing into the same room and as part of a cadre. It's excellent. Somebody does end up winning and, that's cool. But the identification of that group as young writers in terms of career wise, like whatever their actual age is, who are doing things that the community thinks are worthy of note.
And it's an incredibly diverse class this year, which is very cool. And I mean, in style, you've got short story writers, you've got novel length, you've got people of color, you've got women, it's just a great mixture of things from a bunch of different publishers. And I really think we're lucky to have
some. Yeah, and all across the genre spectrum, too. You got very hard sci-fi. Ramiz is writing very near future stuff. B's stories are way out, like really cool far future military things, and among other stuff. Sophia's sui generis. Everybody's sort of exploring their own sort of corner of the universe.
No, I think it's really cool. Sophia Samatar's stuff is sort of like on the literary edge of the genres, and then you've got kind of like you know, Wes Chu, who's very commercial.
Oh gosh, yeah, of course.
Very commercial and very funny, and just has a ton of fun with it, and it kind of got everything in between there too. It is a lot of fun. I think if the purpose of an award is to provide some sort of reading list for somebody in the future, you could do a lot worse than those five writers to get a real good idea of what the genres are all about right now, and that's, mm-hmm. that's really exciting. Have you read most of those people, Tabitha?
So obviously I've read Wes Chu and Max, and who else is there? Ramez is, I haven't read his, but I bought his book recently and I plan to read it because he's just an awesome person. I met him at, you know, WorldCon last year and loved him. So I'll have to be reading that one soon.
Luckily, B. Sridhan Kao is widely available on the internet, since all of her published work, I believe, is short fiction. And so she's all over Clark's World and Lightspeed and all the other Beneath Seethless Skies. So you can find all her stuff online, which is really cool if you haven't had a chance to read her yet. She's...
Oh, yeah. And I downloaded my packet. So I've been chewing through it, and I'm actually about to start Ancillary Justice probably right as soon as I finish the current book I'm working on.
You're about to have a great ride.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what everyone told me. As soon as I sent out a picture on Twitter, they were like, "Oh my God, I love that! You're gonna love it." I'm just like, "Well, that's good. I hope so."
Yeah. Way to fall down on the blogging gig there, Tabitha. You know, the biggest zeitgeist book of last year. I'm just getting to it.
Yeah. You know what? It's like I can't read everything. I am only one person.
I cannot believe that Tabitha has provided me such an excellent segue. It's like she's a professional podcaster. But one of the things I really wanted to talk about tonight is actually kind of Ancillary Justice, not actually about the book, but kind of about the phenomenon that brought Ancillary Justice to everybody's attention. And I thought that the two of you would be interesting to talk to about this, because I think Max, to some degree, has benefited from this as well. And that's that the blogging community has become more and more influential, I think, every year, with creating buzz around certain books and generating an energy behind them within the community that gets them spread far and wide in the review community. And Ancillary Justice is a great example of that. I don't think there's any question that Ancillary Justice would have been as big a success as it has been without that buzz that was created by that word of mouth online. But one of the things I'm always worried about as I think about this is, how far does that buzz extend? How far does that echo chamber go? And I'd be fascinated to kind of get Max's opinion on this. I mean, how important do you think that online community is to the success of a book?
Well, I think the online community right now at this particular moment is essential to the success of certain kinds of books. By that I mean, if a book isn't something that's really riding in a very commercial strike zone that, you know, some large-scale book purchasers are going to look at and say, "Oh, this is amazing, I want, like, a bunch of this." If it's a little further out, then those are the kinds of books that would ordinarily get, like, cult followings over a very long period of time. You know, somebody would read the book, get incredibly excited about it, pass it along, and that sort of old school physical word of mouth effect would kick in. But that can take a while. Whereas right now, I think the blogging and Twitter and Tumblr sort of social media community, especially that's connected with fandom, is coming to a greater degree of awareness of what they've seen a lot of, what they want to see more of, and that other people are maybe sharing similar opinions to them. Like, that there's a shared community of folks who are looking for something from the genre that's not in that traditional commercial strike zone. And for books that are like that, connecting with that community can be incredibly important. Now, that said, I don't think it means that if a book is not getting this kind of traction, it's necessarily going to be a commercial failure, because stuff can just hit in the strike zone and work really, really well, kind of independent of a lot of the buzz that's around that, around them. But certainly in my experience, writing Three Parts Dead and seeing some people get really excited about that and excited about using their platforms to share it with other people who had then used their platforms to share it with other people. It was amazing and was much sort of bigger than I was expecting in that way.
So Tabitha, you're like me in the middle of this on a daily basis, blogging about, writing about, talking about books, covers, and kind of everything under the sun. I mean, what do you think? And when you think about your own influence, I mean, how much do you think, you know, a good review, what does it do for a book? I mean, what are we ultimately trying to accomplish with a, I shouldn't put it that way, not what we're trying to accomplish, but what do we think the end result of our review is?
Oh, I think it has a really big impact. I mean, because obviously all authors know they're always like, you know, if you really like the book, write a review. It helps sales. It really does. Mm-hmm. You know, so our reviews, you know, on our blogs, whether we post them to, you know, the various outlets, I think they have a big impact because, like he said, other people are looking for like-minded readers who can turn them onto things that they want to read. The books that I end up loving and fangirling over, those are the books that I end up pushing on everybody when they find me. They're like, oh, what are you going to read? What should I read? I'm like, this one, and this one. You know, so it's like, not only that, but certain reviewer voices speak to certain people. So if they like the way, you know, that reader, you know, fangirls or writes about all that, you know, everything that they felt when they read that book and everything that they thought, and they identify with that person's voice, then they're like, oh, then I'm really going to probably, you know, enjoy this book as well, since I have these, you know, they feel like they can really key in on what that person's saying, then I think it makes a really big difference. And then you get the ability to be able to share other interests as well. So, you know, obviously I'm mostly a science fiction and fantasy blogger, and those are the books that I read and review, but I read and review an adult as well as young adults. So in that way I can pull in the YA readers and the adult readers and show them that, hey, just because it's this or that, you know, you really like to only read adult, you really might like this in young adult as well. Give it a chance. And it more and more I see that I'm actually pulling young adult readers into reading adult fiction instead, which is my ultimate goal, because I love adult fantasy and I enjoy the YA fantasy more as like a palate cleanser, you know? So not saying that it is kind of easier to read, but I really do think that it makes a big impact, not just in the online community, but if you get bloggers reaching out to their local community. I have a lot of local followers, and so, because people really like to know who you are physically, so just like, you know, how I met you at Worldcon, so now I feel like I know you more so than if I would just be following your blog, you know, for the past year or two. So when you meet someone, it also helps bring it in there more. But having that good voice, I think it really does make people want to read the books if they like that reviewer's voice as well.
It's very gratifying to know that I'm not making people not want to follow me when they meet me.
Yeah,
it's nice to know that I'm not repellent. So I appreciate that, Tabitha. Thank you for that,
no,
that incredible compliment. And
you're quite a compelling person, Justin.
Yes, thank you. No, I think that one of the things that I always think about when I love to ask questions that I get to answer myself. So one of the things I always think about when with blogging is it's not so much what one review does. I mean, I don't have any illusions that even when I post a review that gets several thousand page views, that there's any expectation that review is selling books. But I think that what we run into is we find these trusted voices within the community that people trust. So, you know, I have a certain number of bloggers and a certain number of authors that trust me. And when they read a good review from me, whether it's Ancillary Justice or Goblin Empire or Goblin Emperor or Max's Three Parts Dead, that then they're more likely to read it.
Yes.
And then they read it and they write a review, and then they have their trust circle that sees that and then reads it. And you get this snowball effect where then
exactly.
Certainly.
And I think that's what a lot of times we lose sight of. And I think it's sometimes what publishers can lose sight of in this game, where they're constantly chasing the IO9 review or constantly chasing the, you know, the Tor.com review or the Washington Post review. That really, those will come if you have the grassroots movement. It's just like politics in that way, I think.
Oh, no, I completely agree, because me personally, I don't, yes, I go on Tor.com frequently, actually. Every once in a while, I'll pop onto IO9, but, I do enjoy the Tor.com only because there's a few people now that I've met from the cons that, you know, I'll like to go read their content and that. And sometimes the newsletter, you know, keys my interest when I see various things. But mostly I'm following other bloggers because I want to know what they're reading, and I like finding those little gems. It's like when you go to Tor.com or the big you know, the big sites, they're going to show you what the publisher thinks is really hot. And that may not be what I think is really hot. You know, like, for instance, you'll come across a book that just doesn't get as much push from the publicist or publishers that you may really think it deserves. And that's how you find the gems, is by reading the stuff that other bloggers are reading and saying, oh, well, I didn't even hear about this one. So now I've got to read it, right? So that, I think it's more important to have the smaller blogs and the smaller individual voices, like you said, so you can get the snowball effect.
And especially since those voices exist and propagate outside of the internet community too. I have a story that I think a lot of people who read science fiction and fantasy have. You know, I have, like, my uncle who showed up at one point when he heard that I liked Star Wars and had this big box of paperbacks. And was like, these are the books that you should read, or this is a good place to start, you know? And that box had, you know, my first Roger Zelazny in it, and had the Foundation trilogy, and had these books that, and had the Wizard of Earthsea books. And these all became really kind of constituent pieces of my fantasy. And then I turned around and was recommending them to other people. And so, like, the way that social networks work, it's not all nodes are talking to all other nodes all of the time. It's that there are sort of key nodes that are talking to one another and then disseminating information to this sort of much larger bunch of smaller nodes that have less complex connectivity. They'll all be like looking to one little hub. So the sort of blogger universe is this sort of collection of key nodes that are all communicating with one another. And Justin, you mentioned echo chambers a little bit earlier. I can see how, like, there might be this sort of sense that, well, everybody is just talking to everybody who's talking to everybody. But there's actually something that's much more interesting happening, where everybody who's talking is talking to everybody who's talking to everybody who is talking, if that makes any sense. There's this whole other community of people who are watching, who are not necessarily commenting, but who become aware because there's a sort of critical amount of discussion of books that are exciting or weird or new or just really capturing people's imaginations, that then disseminates out into the wider world.
Preach, brother.
Yes. Yeah, catching fire, yeah. Man.
Oh, hey, Susan Collins reference. Nice work.
I do what I can.
No, I agree with you, Anna, but one of the interesting twists on this, as we talk about bloggers generating buzz and wanting to search out certain books, I think one of the challenges that we face is bloggers are inherently attracted to, we're sort of like birds. We're very attracted to shiny things.
Oh, yes.
And so Three Parts Dead was really shiny. You know, it had this great cover. It's got this, person of color with a glowy pink sword, and it's a Chris McGrath cover. So it's got this great grit to it. It's a very attractive and appealing book, and it was new and different. And then your second book comes out, Two Serpents Rise. You're no longer a debut novelist. You're now a guy that we all know, sort of, and we know what we're going to get.
That kooky weird guy over there in the corner ranting about economies.
Right. And so do you think that it's difficult to continue to penetrate that community and penetrate that buzz with this second novel where people, you're already kind of a known quantity, that I feel like that second book becomes so much harder to build that same amount of buzz on?
I think you're absolutely right there. For me, it was just a very different experience. On the one hand, I wasn't getting the massive boost you get from being somebody who nobody knows. They're sort of the man with no name thing. As you're saying, it's like, oh, shiny, this is interesting. What's going on over here? But the flip side of that was I'd been through the rodeo at least once before. So, and there were people who knew to be looking for the book and to be a little bit excited about it. So I had my bearings more and was able to push for the launch. That said, since Two Serpents Rise wasn't my debut novel, there's a certain amount of cachet that it didn't have as a result. Also, you know, your first book comes out and people kind of use that to decide what they think about you and whether they're interested in picking up the second one, which is really interesting because artists like grow and develop and change from book to book. I've noticed that I'm guilty of this exact thing. I'll read somebody's first novel and think, well, okay, that was good. It had some weaknesses and it's, you know, had some strengths and weaknesses, shelf that for a while. And then, you know, I come back to the same author 5 years later and discover they're doing something that I had no idea how far they could have come, you know? Going in circles a little bit here, I guess, but it's definitely a different track to be running coming around for the second or third time.
I'll tell you, if people judged my podcast the way that they judge second novels, I would not have any listeners, because I've gotten a lot better as this has gone along now on episode 15. But no, I personally find myself incredibly guilty of this, that I really make an effort to read debut novelists and have... And I've become a person that avoids reading series now. Like, I'll read the first book in a series, and typically the first book in a series has enough of a resolution that I can just let it go, and I don't feel any need to read the rest of the series. And as a blogger, I'm constantly chasing new authors and new things and books I've never read before and authors I've never read before, because that's what I'm more interested in writing about. It's very hard to write about an author that you've already written about, because...
Oh, yes, definitely.
Unless the book is really interesting or really new for that author, you end up treading the same ground, particularly in series novels. And I'm sure, Tabitha, you've had a similar experience.
Oh, yeah. Plus, your subscribers and other readers, they don't want to know about, you know, book 13 in a series that they haven't read yet. Who wants to hear about that if you haven't read the entire series? So I'm like you, I used to be a completionist. I would read the entire series, even if it turned to crap, I would just keep going, because I was like, I'm invested. I'm emotionally invested. All this time is invested. I got to finish. Now I'm very easygoing, and I will let it go after book one. I'm like, you know what? I really enjoyed it. It was good. It was a 3. It's not fabulous enough for me to continue, you know, or if I feel like I've gotten some, you know, some closure by the end of that first book, and I don't feel like I'm absolutely in love and I really, really must read the next one, then I'll just let it go. And I have to, you have to cut something. You have to cut it somewhere, because you can only read so many books. You can only read so many books in a year. And every year there are new debut authors that you definitely want to check out. So yeah. And there's way too much series fiction in science fiction and fantasy, which is the point that I wanted to make about your books, because I love the fact that I feel like each one has been something that can stand alone, and I don't, you know, you don't have to have read the other one to read this one. And I'm loving that. So you're doing really
excellent
good there.
Yeah, I was about to say, all this like Boo series talk is making me sort of get really small in my chair over here other end of the line.
Yeah, no, I actually really enjoy books that build on the world, but not on the narrative.
Exactly. So the fact that the first book had completely different characters than the second book has, and the third book as well, it's like it's all about the world. The characters are very important, but it's like you're getting this one great experience, but you still are in this fabulous world that you love, you know, and you can pull in the other characters now and then, but you don't feel like you're missing anything. And I think that's the bad thing that happens with a lot of series fiction writers, as well as when they do like spin-off series, is that someone will pick up that book and they'll feel like, I'm missing all sorts of information.
Right, whereas, exactly. Where's the continuity? Yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah. So much continuity here. What's going on?
Yes.
This is something that I loved about Terry Pratchett. I found him relatively early in the sort of Pratchett mania in the States, at least in terms of the large scale distribution of his books, like back when they were still kind of coming out in drabs of, you know, 2 or 3 a year would like finally get repackaged for American consumption. And so they would come also out of order. You'd get one book that was early in the Guard sequence and one book that was the most recent book in the Guard sequence, and then like a book in the middle of The Witches. And this may have also been an artifact of me growing up in small town Tennessee, so sort of at the mercy of what my bookshop carried or what my booksellers knew to be able to recommend to me. So I came upon these books, and it was amazing how it was, you had this sort of fractally complicated world where you could explore different parts of it really deep in. And if you knew enough about this, the world, you could start to recognize the hooks that were binding everything together. And even over time, the more books I got and the more I kind of put the mosaic together, there was a sort of emerging overall plot line, but it wasn't an overall plot line in the way that the sort of Wheel of Time books were running an overall plot line. It wasn't like we needed to stop the 13 Forsaken and unify the kingdoms and break the seals and this and that and the other thing. And all of that needed to be done. And then we have the last battle. It was just the world was changing and the characters were changing within the world. That was something that seemed really fascinating to me and played with my own interests in sort of expanded universes. I was a big Star Wars EU geek when I was a kid, and still am kind of an enormous Star Wars EU geek, though I have resistance to the Yuuzhan Vong, but that's a whole other story.
I would just like to apologize to all of our listeners that Max Gladstone just completely spoiled the Wheel of Time for you.
Oh, sorry, guys. No, okay. In all fairness, that's like very much first book stuff, right? There are so many forces. How many? It's right there in the map, even. Like, I found Tigana, Guy Gabriel Kay's Tigana, read it for the first time relatively late in my sort of fantasy reading career. And after I'd been reading a lot of science fiction and a lot of like more kind of modern urban fantasy stuff, like basically books that don't have maps. And so I opened up Tigana and there was this beautiful map. And I knew on page one that we were going to go around the map collecting people from all of the corners of the map and having an adventure in each city and forming this sort of city band of ragtag adventurers who are then going to go and confront some sort of big nasty thing. It was this like wonderful feeling of coming home. And then of course the book does all these wonderful things to subvert all of those expectations and play with them, knowing that you're going to have that as soon as you look at the map. There's so much information that comes even in sort of large scale trad fantasy in just the very earliest breath of the world.
No, maps are fascinating. And I don't think you have not done a map in any of your books yet, have you, Max? I can't remember.
I haven't, actually.
No, I'm looking. Nope, he doesn't.
Nope, no maps yet. There are several versions of a world map in a moleskin in my house. And I use that to kind of chart where everything is from everything else. And that's relatively clear in my head. But I've been getting away with it so far, mostly by virtue of the fact that all of the books are contained within individual cities or sort of geographical areas that are immediately adjacent to cities. So even for Full Fathom 5, where the geography is kind of important, it's relatively easy to sketch out the layout of like one island and where everything is in relationship to one another, so the reader can hold that in their head without necessarily having the map very detailed. But it's a conversation that we've been going back and forward with, and maybe there will be a map in the future, especially when people start ping-ponging around the map a little bit more.
Oh, I do have a question. So I believe I heard somewhere, might have been from your publicist, about the titling of your books with the Three Parts Dead, The Two Serpents Rise, Full Fathom 5, that they're actually out of order. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I wrote this enormous sort of half facetious apology to the internet / readership community on Tor.com a little while ago about that. Basically, I had this experience when I was a kid reading Stephen Bruce Jarek books and also reading the Discworld novels and thinking like, gosh, this is wonderful. And it's relatively clear where individual stories are in relationship to one another in their own timeline, but not where they fall in the kind of absolute chronological order. There are some moments where the streams cross, but without those, the witches' books could be taking place 300 years in front of the guard books, and you'd never know, really.
Yeah.
So I thought, as I was working on the first sort of couple craft sequence books, why don't I just put the numbers in the title so it'll be clear where they kind of fall on the timeline. So somebody will pick up this book and say, oh, yes, okay, this is going to happen after this stuff and before this stuff. This will happen earlier in the chronology. This will happen later in the chronology and would allow me to kind of bounce around a bit, which has been great for me personally because I keep finding different aspects of the world's history and present and future, like, particularly interesting. And so there's kind of evolving thematic thread to the entire series that's moving forward in publication order. But sometimes that means that I need to go back and investigate something that happens 20 or 30 years before a lot of the central action of the later books. So that's been really cool for me, but it does get people a bit confused, which I feel kind of embarrassed about. But read in publication order is good. And I think they should also make sense if you read them in sort of chronological order too. But it'd be a different experience. It'd be like reading the Darkover books in chronological order. Some things that show up later as a surprise or something would be clear earlier.
This is kind of making my head hurt, only because
See, this is the reason I feel kind of guilty about this whole thing.
It's not because I'm dumb. It's just hold on. Now listen, hear me out here. So I just realized that you have numbers in all of your book titles, and I'm glad to hear that that is a reason for that. But what's interesting is these are not made up phrases.
No.
You've pulled all of these phrases from quotes, basically, from various literary texts or quotes from famous people.
Except for Two Serpents Rise. That one I just made up, I have to admit.
Well, now you're just breaking my theory. But do you like spend time Googling, like, okay, quotes that have the number 4 in them?
I do. I absolutely do. I would be lying if I said that I didn't. And sometimes it's a phrase that pops out of the book that's really vital, but sometimes it's poking around and thinking, oh, it'll work well for this. There was an original title for Full Fathom Five. It was actually Five Eyes Break, which is a Dylan Thomas reference, but that seems to be a little bit confusing. And the and Full Fathom Five actually works really well. I wasn't intending the book to have any references to The Tempest when I was starting off, but there are a lot of thematic parallels, even if there's not much even if there's no obvious Prospero figure going on. Yeah, so there's a bit of Google searching and a bit of racking my own brains and a bit of what sounds good and where's the story going.
Well, I enjoyed connecting the quote reference Three Parts Dead to your thematic layering when I did my review of Three Parts Dead. Whether there was anything actually connected to it, I enjoyed trying to connect that.
Oh, no, absolutely. I thought that essay that you wrote was really insightful, actually, because the Three Parts Dead... The Bertrand Russell quote from which the title is coming ends up being really core to the way that a lot of the characters are living their lives and the problems that they're facing, like the issue of sort of fearing love and your own ability to exist within within proper relationships, sort of mutually exchange based relationships with other people as being sort of central to moral life keeps coming back up again and again in Three Parts Dead. It's obviously something that De Novo, sort of the villain of the piece, is like really not into, and deals with the characters' relationships with their gods and the question of what of sort of being in a position where you're afraid to love someone or something, you're afraid of the kind of power that gives them over you or the consequences of it. So yeah, I keep finding apposite quotes that work really well thematically with the rest of the books. And if I,
That's a pretty funny point, because I like in my reviews, I like to come up with some weird random quote from either like musics or movies to put into my reviews right before each paragraph. So it's like, now I'm going to have to start digging up and trying to find every time one of your titles comes out. I'm like, where is this from?
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to Max's fourth book, which will be 4 Score and 7 Years Ago.
Oh, excellent.
You can write a split narrative that's non-chronolinear that actually satisfies both the fourth and the seventh installment in the series.
Justin. You're tempting me down the path that rocks here, Justin.
Yes, yes.
All right, I'm going to make a note of that.
Or two separate novellas that you could release separately. One will be 4 Score and the other one will be 7 years ago.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Marco, my editor's popping up here on Skype just shaking his fist at me, so I don't know what that means, but it's probably good.
No doubt. One of the things that's really hallmark in all of your books that I've experienced is you really have taken a lot of – you've clearly made an effort to be – diverse in your cast of characters. You're not shooting for the default. I assume that's an intentional thing by you, or is that something that's just sort of come organically through the story?
It's intentional. I try regularly when I'm putting characters together for these books to conceive of the role that the character is going to play, sort of independent of their orientation in the world. And I mean orientation, sexual, racial, sort of gender identity, all social class even. Sometimes you need a bouncer, sometimes you need someone who's going to, sometimes you need a protagonist even. And then thinking about how I can kind of fill in these choices sort of sometimes almost randomly to start off, like, Your initial instinct whenever you're trying to fill a blank space is going to be shaped by your own ideological background, right? So you need to be really suspect of knee-jerk desires, which is a dangerous thing in storytelling because so much of it, right, is like the centipede that's trying to learn how to dance or the caterpillar. Do you know the story at all?
No.
There's a caterpillar that's walking across a branch, and sort of spider comes down and is looking at the caterpillar. I'm like, man, it's really interesting that you can walk with so many legs. Like, man, if I had that many legs, I'd get all tangled up and it'd be crazy. How do you walk with that many legs? And centipede's like, well, let me think about it. And centipede starts trying to figure out how it walks and, of course, trips over all of its own feet and falls down to the ground because it's sort of moving on instinct, but it doesn't necessarily know how to move in a kind of intellectual way. And when I started writing anyway, a lot of the things that I was doing were very reflexive. Kind of, I've engaged a lot of texts. I've read a whole bunch of stuff. I'm really passionate about writing fantasy stories and science fiction stories and wizards and spaceship books. I want to do that. And the first several things that came out were just kind of reflexive and as a result embodying a lot of, you know, my own ideological notions. So then starting before Three Parts Dead for a long way, but I try these days to think about whether I'm creating a character who is a certain way or, you know, is acting in a certain way because that's what I've been told about those sorts of people. It's like that's kind of something that I'm hearing from the culture and ideology in which I've grown up, or if that's something that's kind of inherent to this particular character, if there's an internal logic that works very well from that character's subjective viewpoint as opposed to from my sort of imposed godlike perception. And I guess this is getting really abstract and far out. So yes is the short answer. I really try to make characters and worlds that are representative of a much wider range of people than, you know, I realized far too late that I was growing up reading in a lot of fantasy and science fiction novels.
I wrote a piece this week about the death of one of my childhood heroes, who was Tony Gwynn, a baseball player.
I read that.
Yeah, from San
Diego
Padres.
That was a great piece.
And this, what you're talking about actually is something I've been thinking about for a long time, but it kind of really hit me unique when Gwynn died. And I had really idolized him as a child because I saw something of myself in him. I was a very heavy kid, played sports, but I was always very heavy. And that was a challenge because nobody thought I could be good just because I was heavy. And when I saw Tony Gwynn play, I saw somebody who was like me. I'm sure if I told Tony Gwynn this before he died, he would have been like, why are you idolizing me because I was chubby? But I did. It was cool. It was so important for me to see somebody that I could identify with who was succeeding at something I wanted to succeed at. And as I thought about it, I mean, it absolutely – that same emotion applies – to wanting to, if I'm a transgender person or a person of color or a woman, that I see somebody like me reflected in the things I love. And today, the thing that I love is science fiction and fantasy. And of course, I see lots of me in science fiction and fantasy, but I'm sure even, you know, Tabitha being a woman probably maybe doesn't see as much of her in these books.
You know, I don't think that's true because I know that there's a big push going on right now with female authors and making sure that they get just as much of a chance to be successful, you know, as male authors. And I can totally understand that. But, as a female, I read, you know, just as much, from male authors as I do from female authors. And I see just as much of, like you said, I see just as much of myself and my interests and things that I enjoy reflected back when I read those books. In fact, when I want a certain story, I tend to gravitate towards, you know, a male author, or if I want a certain feeling in somewhere, something else, then I'll go towards a female author. So I think, I really don't agree with that because especially humor-wise. For instance, a recent book that I just finished, Traitor's Blade by Sebastian de Castell, I was absolutely loved that. I felt like the humor was, you know, spot on, my kind of humor. And I was like, I think that sometimes people get, you know, get this feeling that, oh, you know, well, this isn't going to appeal to this, you know, to this, you know, gender or this race or whatever. When I think that's absolutely wrong, because women can have just as naughty of a sense of humor as guys can, just as dark. We like blood and gore. And it's like that article I read about the gaming. Women game just as much as men do, you know, and yes, maybe some of those games are built to, you know, really cater to men, or they think that men are going to be the ones playing them when women are going to be the ones playing them, you know, just as much. So I really don't think that's what it is. Ultimately, write what you want, and I'm going to read what I want. And you know, it doesn't matter what, you know, gender is the author or the characters, because I don't avidly seek out, you know, a specific kind of book that features a specific kind of character. It's like, I will read it all, you know, it's just, yeah.
Well, I think Tabitha, you're getting at something that's really interesting aspect of this larger conversation, which is the sort of the notions of essentialism that can tends to creep in when we start talking about this general issue. Like that there are certain kinds of books or kinds of writers or characters or situations that are inherently male or inherently female. And you start seeing that. I see this a lot in essays about the YA community, especially the kind of recurrent boys aren't reading these girl books sort of thing that just mushrooms up every few months, or at least I see mushroom up every few months, you know? Yeah. Whereas when I was growing up, I was reading a lot of those girl books. I mean, I wasn't reading Babysitter's Club, I was more of a Boxcar Children kind of guy, but I cut my teeth on Robin McKinley. I checked out The Hero and the Crown like so many times that they gave me a copy of the book when I left grade school, you know? But at the same time, I think there's a real value to seeing characters who are not necessarily like you, but are from a world, like a subjective world that you recognize in a book. I spent a decent amount of time in China teaching and traveling. And there's something funny that happens when you've lived abroad for a year or two, or even longer, where people from home start to feel really important. Not because you share all of these tons of experiences with them or because you're just like so desperate, but because they share a kind of subjective world that has a lot of common points with yours, that no matter how close you're getting to someone who's just not from your home, there, you know, there's a certain amount of translation that needs to happen. And so I think there is a really powerful effect for reading someone in a story who doesn't need to agree with you necessarily, doesn't need to act the way you're going to act, or doesn't need to, and certainly doesn't need to act in some kind of essentialized vision of the way a trans person acts or a black person acts or you know, straight white cis man acts. But is someone that you recognize who is doing hero stuff or, you know, who's acting, who has some agency, who is involved in the working out of the story. Part of the reason that I wanted to write a Full Fathom 5 with the main character who is a trans woman was, of all things, a sort of Tumblr conversation where I saw another fantasy author who, you know, I forget who, say that, like, at some point, I'm not sure I'd ever write a character, a trans character in one of my stories just because it would end up being so much about gender identity. And I thought, well, I mean, can't you? Like, does it need to be all about somebody's gender struggles necessarily? Those books are really important to have. They're really important to read. They're really important to write. But can't you just have a character who is trans, who is doing hero stuff? You don't want only that, obviously. You need a whole universe of texts to try to do all of the work that needs to be done.
I completely agree. I think that it's too much like they're treating it like it's an issue. It's not an issue. It's normal. It really is. So
it is. I mean, it is
part of the book. Then it's normal. So it doesn't need to become an issue. So that is strange. That I like that you have a transgender person and as a main character. Heck, I one of the other books that I read in that new weird genre, The Waking Engine, he had one of his main characters was gay. And I was like, this is great. I'm loving it. It's not that it's because, he's gay. It's just that there was diversity, and diversity is great. I still would have enjoyed it either way. And it wasn't an issue. It wasn't one of the main issues of the book. It was just, like it was treated like it was normal, because it is.
I think authors in general should write what they want to write, and it will find a readership or it won't. But I do think it's very important that the marketplace as a whole provides images that children and young readers and older readers of all ages, shapes, colors, sizes, genders, and non-binary genders or whatever, the whole spectrum, have somebody that they can see, as Max says, doing hero stuff. I think it's incredibly powerful to be able to read somebody that you can see something of yourself in, doing those kinds of things and having those kinds of journeys. If books only exist in the marketplace that are white cis men doing hero stuff, then it reinforces this notion that only white cis men can do hero stuff, and that's not the message I think anybody wants to send.
Definitely.
There's a great bit at the beginning of Slavoj Žižek's movie, A Pervert's Guide to Ideology, which is like he's done these two movies that are basically film criticism from Slavoj Žižek land. And he starts off talking about how we all exist within this sort of ideological framework, and how we have these desires for escape, but it's in that moment that we kind of escape into dreams, into fantasy land, basically, that we are most at risk of falling prey to precisely this kind of ideological matrix, that like the dream into which we escape is itself structured by the matrix in which we grow up. And that's something that has been very much on my mind with this entire conversation about sort of representation. Did any of you guys see The Wolf of Wall Street, this Scorsese movie?
Oh, no.
I don't go to movies because I have children.
We read books.
Okay, fair enough. This is also not a movie that you want to necessarily bring your children to. But it's very interesting because it's this fundamentally warped world that the central character, Belfort, is inhabiting, and the Leonardo DiCaprio character. And you don't notice, but one of the things that's fundamentally warped about it, for sort of 2 hours of film, you see maybe one or two characters who are not straight white cis men, and they're generally in these very coded sort of subservient roles. And there's one moment where you get like the view of the world outside of this sort of monomaniacal Leonardo DiCaprio character's head. It's just an FBI agent who's sitting on a normal subway car that's full of all different sorts of people who are behaving in different sorts of ways. You've got like, there's an old Chinese couple, there's a black guy reading a newspaper, there's just there's a wide range of New York inhabitants on the subway car. And you realize how jaundiced the perspective of the entire rest of the movie, which is through this Belfort character's eyes, has been. And I feel like that's a kind of danger that we have. It's why I was talking about reflexes before. Coming to write books, you can instinctively create something that doesn't actually look like the world that you really do inhabit. And that's a problem for your art. And it's something to get better about. And it's been a problem for mine. It's something I continue to work at and fail at all the time, and then need to, scrap huge sections of drafts and reapproach. But yeah, it's the struggle.
Well, Full Fathom 5, I believe, is due out on July 15th, Max.
Yes, July 15th.
Are you doing any tour stops while you're out and about on this one? Are you going to be present at some bookstores and such?
I'll be present at a few bookstores. I'm doing a little bit of a run around beforehand. I'll be at 4th Street Fantasy this next weekend, actually, in Minneapolis. And then I'll be at ReaderCon in Burlington, Massachusetts. And I'll be having a launch party at Pandemonium Books and Games in Cambridge in Central Square. I think we'll be at a Barnes & Noble in Framingham a few days later. The launch party's on the 15th. And then we'll be at a Barnes & Noble in Framingham a few days, maybe a week later. And there are a couple other events that are going on all at my website, maxgladstone.com, which is very unimaginatively URL'd.
Very nicely done, Max. That was an excellent promotional riff that you just did there. I'm impressed.
I do what I can.
I'm impressed. Well, thank you both for being here tonight. For those of you who have not visited Tabitha's blog before, it is notyetread.com. She is excellent, and I encourage you to go check her out.
Hooray!
Thank you both so much for being here tonight.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Max, say thank you. Yeah, good job.
Max.
It's been a long day. Great conversation. Thank you guys so much for having me on. This is a lot of fun.
Now get back to writing so we can
This has been Rocket Talk.